like to remind you to silence your cell phones and pagers. Welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophists here in Philadelphia. As you are aware, the policy of the Lodge is independent devotion to the cause of Theosophy. Practically, that means that it is up to each one to decide for themselves how they will participate, even if they will participate in time, service, or the contribution of money. All these things are important, all are needed, all are gratefully received, but there is no obligation imposed or implied, except that we might say that it is expected that we will all maintain a spirit of mutual tolerance and unity in the consideration of these ideas, putting aside all dissensions and differences of individual opinion in order to help each other gain a fundamental grasp of these teachings of Theosophy so that we each can gain a truer realization of the self and a profounder conviction in universal brotherhood, because this is the basis of unity among Theosophists wherever they are situated, a similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching. And so here in Philadelphia, in keeping with these lines laid down by the great founders of the Theosophical movement, we have a program which consists of two weekly meetings. On Sunday mornings from 11 to 12, we have a formal presentation of the philosophy of Theosophy in the form of either a lecture, a shorter talk or forum, or a panel. This morning, we are going to have a shorter talk or forum, and which will leave more times for questions and answers, and we'll get into that in a moment. Next Sunday, we actually begin a new month and therefore a new umbrella theme, which actually is the third object of the Theosophical movement, the investigation of the hidden laws in nature. So naturally, the first question that comes to mind is, well, what do we mean and how do we recognize the hidden side of nature? So that is the title of our first talk next Sunday, The Hidden Side of Nature. And then on Wednesday evenings, we have, during the winter cycle of work, a study class in the Ocean of Theosophy by William Q. Judge. And we are in the chapters in that book that deal with reincarnation. And we're at the point where we're considering the different objections that come up. And one thing that's interesting about being open-minded enough to consider objections is that in considering objections, we get a better understanding of the philosophy in answering and in addressing those objections. So Theosophy encourages each to test, check, and verify for themselves. So whatever ideas come up in the way of questions need to be addressed. And so we see that one of the objections that comes up in the mind, particularly of Western persons, people grown up in Western civilizations, is that if reincarnation is true, why don't I remember my past lives? So the subject for this Wednesday's class is, does lack of memory of previous lives disprove reincarnation? And as I said, that meeting begins at 7:45 and ends at 9:00. Also on Wednesday, we have a library located in the front of the building here on the first floor, which is open from 5:30 till 7:30. The purpose of the library is to allow each for independent study in those areas that are of interest to them. So there is a full line of straight Theosophical literature available, as well as a library of very interesting books in various fields of human discipline, which help round out and broaden our Theosophical research. So there is Always a student there as a librarian to help you investigate and find the resources you're looking for. So it is a reference library. It's not a lending library. For those, and those hours is from 5:30 to 7:30. And as we said, if one is interested, and of course it's encouraged to gauge an independent study, there is a book table in the center of the building, which is open from during library hours and before and after meeting. And on that book table, you will find straight line theosophical literature available at the cost of publication and shipping only. There's no profit to be made from the sale of these books, as the support of this building financially depends solely on the generous and independent contributions of associates and friends of the work. So this morning then, we are finishing up the umbrella topic and theme for January, that is the path of spiritual evolution. And so this morning we'll have a short talk followed by more time for questions and answers. And the subject for this morning is a very thought-provoking one and always a timely one, and that is the power of faith and will prayer. So in order for that we have a jumping-off point for this discussion, we'll now have a volunteer who will present a short talk on this topic.
Every human being has faith. Faith in something, someone, a home team, some ideal, some conception, some religion, some formula. But while the faiths of different people have one or another object, the faith itself proceeds from the highest and is inherent in the heart of every being. Faith is the very basis of our nature. Whatever way we follow is because of the faith we have, the conviction that it is the best way. That the world is full of false faiths is because of the differing ideas, beliefs, and philosophies which limit faith itself to the means thought necessary for obtaining a particular object of faith. In the 17th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, faith is said to be of three kinds. Faith of the quality called sattva, the good and the true. Faith of the quality called rajas, of action and passion. And faith of the quality called tamas, or indifference and ignorance. These three qualities given to faith are in fact the three limitations placed on faith by every human being. For the power of it, faith is in itself limitless. It is evident then that we ought to be sure of the nature of the faith upon which our ideal are placed. If one places his faith on anything external, whatever it may be, gods or men, religions or systems of thought, he has limited the very power of his own spirit to expand itself beyond the limitations of his ideal. When, for instance, we accept the idea that nothing is real but that which we can see, hear, touch, smell, we have placed our faith on an extremely low basis. There is a reason for our falsity of thought and action when we assume that the present moment is the only moment, the outward terrestrial world and this one existence to be the only life from which we go, we know not where, nor to what purpose it has all been. to look on all beings according to one's own limitations of mind and range of perception, and to see only their externalities of speech and action, is not seeing them as they really are. An outside God, or an evil outside devil, an outside law, an outside atonement for sins, the idea of sin being other than a denial of our own spiritual nature, are all external faiths of the nature of Thomas, of ignorance. Ignorance always leads to superstition. Superstition leads to false belief, and false belief to false faith. We are all in constant conflict with each other because of false bases of faith. For the very reason that faith fixed on anything will bring results, and men are blinded to real and true faith by the results of even false faith. Yet so long as we have false faith, shall we continue to create for ourselves lives of misery. We have produced the effects we see, but we need not go on repeating the same mistakes life after life, if we will but change our ideals. We have to find a true basis of faith. We have to place our faith upon that which is not external, but internal. The internal is the very source of the powers that we possess of every kind, and that internal is the same in every living being. At the very root of our being is that changeless self, which we can only know within ourselves. To reach into it, we must first divest ourselves of all old ideals, of everything which changes. We are not bodies, we are not minds, nor are we both together, but we are that which uses and sustains them both. Through all the changes of the past and present, and those that are to come, we shall always be ourselves. Even when death comes, we shall still be operating in another way than in the physical body. The basis of the changeless self places the whole universe within the reach of any being's mind, a stable basis for thought and action and realization within himself. Men may go from faith to faith, from faith in one thing to faith in some other thing, moving along from life to life and obtaining some results according to the nature of that ideal upon which his faith is fixed at any given point in time. But the only way out is through the faith in the spiritual, essential nature of all beings. And no greater gift could be given to any human being than the undeniable fact that he and each one of us has the power to realize that. We began by telling you about, in so many words, just how misunderstood the power of faith really is. We'll continue by telling you of another equally misunderstood power. That is the power of will prayer. Prayer is a word that usually conveys the idea of some favor or advantage sought from a God outside of ourselves. Even the dictionary defines it as a supplication or plea to God or persons. But who is God? With the exception of the gross materialists, all believe in God, either as a person, however high, or as a power, however divine. But outside of the human heart and outside of the universe, Theosophy teaches God to be the Supreme Spirit, omnipresent and omnipotent, the root and the source of all beings. And man is its crystal ray and a beam of immaculate light within the form of material clay. It is the highest privilege of man to commune with God because he is a self-conscious being. The human consciousness is a link between the divine and the personal. So man can choose to move in one direction or another, either to unite with the Supreme Self within or get victimized by the lower and personal self. Prayer is the outpouring of the human heart in utmost humility and reverential gratitude for all the blessings of life. There is no thought of personal gain, no petition for personal favors, because God, from the theosophical point of view, is also law, universal and impersonal, which cannot be deviated from its own course by human petitions. As Buddha advises in the Light of Asia, pray not, the darkness will not brighten. Ask not from the silence, for it cannot speak. Vex not your mournful minds with pious pains. Ah, brothers and sisters, seek naught from the helpless gods by gift and hymn, nor bribe with blood, nor feed with fruits and cakes. Within yourself, deliverance must be sought. Each man his prison makes. It is the wrong type of prayer that kills self-reliance and makes one dependent on priests and ceremonies, temples and churches. The right understanding of God and prayer enables one to become self-dependent on the basis of inner dependence. As there is a unity of life, so human solidarity is a fact, and each one is his brother's keeper, and therefore responsible for his own thoughts, words, and deeds. True prayer is a yearning of the human heart, its ardent wish to be united with its divine parent, to seek its guidance and reflect its light in the daily affairs of life. This is the real significance of prayer. The highest type of prayer is will prayer. The intensity of our fervent aspirations changes prayer into the philosopher's stone, or that which transmutes lead into pure gold. The only homogeneous essence, our will prayer, becomes the active or creative force producing effects according to our desire. But this has to be done with the purest of motives, realizing one's own responsibility to oneself and to humanity and dedicating oneself to the service of others. Mr. Crosby explains in his answers to questions on the ocean of theosophy, spiritual will is developed by true unselfishness, a sincere and full desire to be guided, ruled, and assisted by the higher self, and to do that which and suffer only whatever the highest self has in store for one by way of discipline or experience. To command and perfect the will is one's duty, and it leads to white magic or true wisdom. As H.P.B. states in Volume 1 of Isis Unveiled, one common vital principle pervades all things, and this is controllable by the perfected human will. H.P.B. also states in Volume 2 of Isis Unveiled, the world needs no sectarian church, whether of Buddha, Jesus, Muhammad, Swedenborg, Calvin, or any other. There being but one truth, man requires but one church, the temple of God within us, walled in by matter, but penetratable by anyone who can find the way. The pure in heart see God. And finally, from an ancient Greek philosopher named Epicurus, it is folly for a man to pray to the gods for that which he has the power to obtain by himself.
Yes.
During the talk, we weren't sure if the speaker said that we should have interdependence or interdependence, but we're wondering if we should have both.
Should we have independence and interdependence? One or the other, or should we have both? Yes.
I thought he just said interdependence, or interdependence.
Yes.
Interdependence. INNER.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we'll ask the speaker, which did you say?
Inner.
INNER. Okay. So we should have inner dependence. Well, what is the difference then between inner dependence and interdependence? Yes.
If we are looking within inner dependence for what was described and being able to make ourselves fit to live a certain way, that brotherly altruistic life, then interdependence becomes obvious to us because we do nothing for ourselves without it affecting everything and everyone around.
So inner dependence, I-N-N-E-R, is a recognition of one's divine spiritual nature. Interdependence is the recognition that the divine spiritual nature within us is the same in each and all. There is no fundamental unit separateness, but all is one. So we might say that they are two aspects of the same reality, but different applications of it. One is recognizing the self within as well as the self with all as being one, and the way we apply those principles. Yes?
Well, we think the hardest thing about this whole subject is at what point do you sort of give up and resign yourself to whatever you have? In other words, we don't want to wallow in disease, but we don't want to go too far the other way, trying to resist what karma has brought us. And we think that is the hardest line to find.
Yes. So would it be correct to state the contribution or the question is, at what point do we accept things for the way they are and just deal with them? Or at what point do we try to change them?
Well, yes, but not to just deal with them. I mean, just live with it. Instead of having that effort
to try to change it,
make it better, fix it, correct it.
So at what point do we accept it, and at what point do we try to change it? Because we might say in the context of our subject of here of prayer, if we are praying, whether by will prayer or prayer to some outside being, it is a supplication or a plea or an effort to make changes for the better as receive them. Whereas in the other case, one recognizes the condition and works within it or accepts it without trying to change it to a better condition. So it is a hard thing to do, to know when to change something and when to just try to live with it or accept it. And since it's such a individual and personal thing, we're going to refrain from giving a general answer but open it up to discussion for the very fact that what one person decides to live with and accept, another person absolutely has to change, because in their condition, good, what is perceived as good is different from another. So we'll just ask for some individual contributions in here is how do you decide as to when something needs to be changed or just accepted and understood? Yes?
Well, not to get to confuse words, we thought of the word supplication. And then the next word we thought of, application. So it would seem that we can independently apply what is called I will prayer. And that ends that we must apply. by that which we already know. And we're asking the chair to carry it from there because at that point we need a clarification. The difference between supplication and application.
Well, supplication is asking for outside help. Application is the internal power to apply, which you already know you have and you can do. But to get back to some other contributions on how you might individually decide as to when to make a change, to exert your faith and your will to, for something better, as to when to exert your faith and will to tolerate and accept and endure. Yes?
Well, you know, on the one hand, we can get lofty and metaphysical and say, oh, it requires such wisdom to really know all of the long-term ripple of effect and the dynamics of all this crazy stuff. But really, it comes down to your values. You know, how were you raised? Is this consistent with it? And if there's anything within your value system that you think that you ought to improve upon based on your experience, you can do that, make the appropriate adjustments. But if your outside world is inconsistent with what you know to be right for you,
mm-hmm. then
make the adjustments. Sometimes you make adjustments to your own value system. That's appropriate too.
So that gets back to the original point that it's hard to give a general rule for everyone where one's value as to what is good and right can vary. But this also gets to the idea of spiritual evolution, don't we see? As we evolve spiritually in our understanding of our interdependence, and our connection with all, our values change, or the application. And so that what at one time we were willing to put up with and endure, at another point we absolutely have to make or change in ourselves and in the conditions around us. Another thought.
And in a way that they kind of work together, acceptance seems to be an initial stage in the process of transmutation. That it's almost an initiatory time, which opens this dialogue between our higher and lower selves. And what we once thought was a disease, but maybe could be just the form of the teaching.
Mm-hmm. So it's interesting that the value of the experience then is not so much in the condition, but in our attitude, the dialogue, the learning, the wisdom that goes through it. Because if, as Theosophy teaches, we've been incarnating life after life, as individuals, we've been through every possible human experience. So human experiences that we've overcome, and human experiences which we've failed to overcome, and human experiences which we just endured. All we have of those experiences, because we don't remember them now, is the wisdom and knowledge accumulated from them. So the real, we might say, value of whether we're going to endure a situation or whether we're going to change it is the wisdom we bring to it and the wisdom we learn from it and can share with others. So if we bring it down to that issue, is what am I going to learn from this experience? Whether I change it or not, what am I going to learn from it about myself or human nature? That seems to be the constant throughout all these things, because everything else we might say is variable from one human being to another, but we each can learn from the experience. Yes, in the back.
We think one of the most valuable things that we were ever given in answer to this was, don't change it until you understand its root. Otherwise, you're cropping off the top of the weed,
yes,
and it's going to come back.
Yes.
So use whatever it is, even if it's painful and miserable, as a way to understand its source in yourself.
Mm-hmm. So that's another way of saying to learn from it. And it certainly makes sense. If there's a condition there that we find very painful, and we decide we're going to use all our effort of faith and will and everything we've learned to change it because it hurts or it's painful, but we don't understand how it got there, we don't understand its cause, we may change it temporarily, but if the seed, the cause is still there, we may just very well create it for ourselves in the future. We haven't learned anything. So first, sometimes in the endurance of something, the acceptance of something, the observing of it first, you learn the lesson, and then you can better change it, or at least change the circumstances which brought it about so it doesn't affect you in the future. Yes?
And we wonder, too, if you use the measuring stick of if it has affected, whatever it is that's going on, has affected your quality of life. That might be an idea, too, that, but then again, try and find out the underlying cause of it, but if it's affecting your quality of life and your relationships with others, then to really look for that seed that's causing the problem. Mm-hmm.
Well, this is true, but quality of life is a very relative thing, is it not? What does our idea of quality of life depend on? How do we know if something's for or opposed to our quality of life? Yes?
Well, if we stick with the analogy of the seeds and the roots and everything, our quality of life depends on whether or not we cut the grass. Grass is beautiful if you manage it, but if you don't, then it's a weed. Mm-hmm. Does that mean we have to go out and rip it out by the roots and get all the seeds? No. Mm-hmm. Manage it. Keep it beautiful.
So another thing there is our quality of life there is to maintain beauty. But that also, but does that, our point is that our understanding of what our quality of life is goes fundamentally to our conviction or belief in what is real and true, or our faith. If we have faith, deep faith, in the idea that beauty, goodness, and truth is the fundamental thing upon which we have our belief and conviction in life, that's real, then all our quality of life is going to depend on how much it lives up to it. And we will tolerate or not tolerate conditions accordingly. But if our faith is placed in something else, not beauty, but the equality of experience, the fact that even long grass has just as much to exist as short grass, why should it be cut? It has as much as right to be long as it. Who are we to decide whether something is beautiful or not by whether it looks short or long to us? That's a different faith. That's a different conviction of what is true. It's a different value, and that person will act differently. So once again, we see how all pervasive and how influential in every aspect of our life, this understanding of what do we believe is true at the time? Where is our faith? And to begin to question it, because we can see that very often our differences, our conflicts, our misunderstandings of ourselves and others gets back to fundamental ideas and not to the reality of who and what we are and our identity of powers. Yes?
Do you think faith and karma helps us to understand the conditions in which we have to go through or endure? And we take the example of one who has been rejected, and one wonders why one is rejected. Well, if you look within yourself rather than look at the environment, you come to the realization that you are not being rejected. Your body, your race, your condition, and those things may be rejected, but as a part of the whole, you're not rejected at all. So this leads us to think more about who and what we really are, and it helps us to gain a great deal of power over the environment, because the way it thinks and acts doesn't affect us. And so it seems to us that all of the conditions that we go through, they are an opportunity for us to learn. So when we live through them, that's where the education comes, rather than trying to change them. Mm-hmm. Because there are so many aspects to everything that comes to us. So we would know exactly where to begin to change it, but from the idea that it's painful. Experiences they're very difficult, and there are aspects to them that opens up that we can't see when we are trying to change them because of pain. Okay.
So to consent your contribution, we can recognize that there are multiple faiths throughout the world, varying from individual to individual. But there are a few fundamental things that we all can have faith in, because they are enduring and they're real. And one is the faith in our own self to learn, to know, and experience, and to act. That no one can take from us. We can have faith in the law. We say the law of action and reaction, the fundamental laws of the universe, because they exist. It does not matter whether we believe something will happen or not. In our own personal belief, if we act in a certain way, it will come one way or another under law. And then the third idea is our power or our faith in our ability to change and grow. Even if we make mistake again and again, if we keep moving, if we keep trying, we will eventually learn and grow from the mistake. Nothing remains the same in the same condition eternally without change. Everything's in a process of growth and development. There may be periods when it seems to move faster or slower, but everything is moving forward. We can have faith as all human beings in those fundamental realities of life and begin to make our decisions from that point of view. Now, was there? Yeah, okay, in the back.
We think it helps to remember that if it's a physical condition, as painful as it might be, the philosophy teaches it's the end stage of an old karma. It is the working out of something. You may suffer your whole life. It doesn't matter. It doesn't mean you'll be born with that condition in the next life.
Yes. So the physical and suffering, the pain of the pain that comes from illness, although it is obviously unpleasant, does not have to be an experience which we are afraid of or run away from or deny. We certainly can try to alleviate the pain and suffering if we can on the physical plane. The relief of suffering is always important. However, even while we are in those conditions, there is a lot of things we can learn from the experience and grow in terms of compassion, endurance, the understanding of causes, sympathy for others, how to help another in a similar type situation. If we see that another person is suffering, how else do we know how to help them out of them, how to give them some real practical benefit, unless we've gone through the experience ourselves and learned how to deal with it? Very often in our society, if the only way we know how to deal with pain and suffering is to take a pill, if that's the only way, then the only way we will know how to help another is to give them a pill. Well, where's the self-reliance? Where's the power of faith and will in that? So conditions, painful or pleasant, they're learning experiences, and we can deal with them accordingly. Yes?
Yes. One of the things I think that we should examine when we decide what, you know, the course of action, how does it affect others? Often things are brought to us or given to us that we think just affect us, but in truth, they affect the whole of society. I use this example, Mahatma Gandhi, who, as an Indian national, suffered insults on a regular basis from the colonizers of his land. If he personalized that and thought, oh, you know, it's me, I'm hurt, you know, he said this to me or he did this to me, it was only when he realized the destructive and corrosive effect that it had not only on him, but on all of his fellow countrymen and the colonizers themselves, mm-hmm. that he had to come to the conclusion, this is something that must be changed.
Mm-hmm. We agree in principle with what you're saying. However, do you think it's difficult to really know how we affect others?
Do I think it's?
By how our actions affect others? Or do you think it's straightforward, simple? Because
not always straightforward, simple, but in that particular case, observation would lead you to see that when the high ideals of the philosophy of those people were being cast aside for something that couldn't possibly replace it, because the people who were giving it to them were materialists. They didn't care about these high philosophical ideas that have, we've since realized were possibly the highest that the world has seen in this particular time. Mm-hmm. But they were being cast aside. And even the Indians themselves didn't see the importance of them. Mm-hmm. And they were being cast aside by people who were worshippers of guns, worshippers of high technology, worshippers of material objects. That observation makes one stand up and say, you know, there's something yeah. wrong here. This cannot continue. It'll be detrimental not only to us, but to the occupiers also.
Well, let's just open it up for another in another way for general consideration. If we make a judgment, a value judgment, based on our faith of what is true, as to what the effect of our action, which we think is a good action, will be on another, how do we know that it's not going to have an adverse effect on another or others? You know, it's said that very often the adept will not come forth and appear or do something, because even though that appearance or that action may have a positive benefit on others, that adept knows that will have an equally negative effect, or perhaps even more negative effect, on many others, so they won't act where others might think, well, they should. So, once again, we're asking ourselves to think, yes, we want to act in a way as to knowing how do we affect others, but how do we know what the effects of our actions will be on all the different individuals around us? How do we judge it? Do we judge it by their feelings, the way they respond to it emotionally, by the way they listen to us, by what they do? Where do we make that decision? Yes.
Well, it's difficult, and you don't know. We could think immediately, you know, if there's a crowd of people and you see a bus coming, I mean, you can either yell or go push them. I mean, then you can see the immediate result. But so much of this, we were talking about karma. I mean, what comes to us is ours, and you don't know what the effect of your actions are going to be. But you need to have the faith to, how can we put it? You need to have the faith to know that what you're doing is the right thing. That if you feel the motivation to do it, but we don't know. We can't tell in many times what, you know, should we go this way or that way? And we guess the will prayer would come into
Hold up.
We haven't talked about.
We'll hold on to the essence of that contribution, that we don't know what the effect will be. We can't trace all the ripples yet. But we have to have faith in what we do, that will, in order to act, in order to exert that will prayer. I will do something because I have faith that it is the right thing to do. Yes, another thought.
We understand what the previous speaker was saying, and we think we're right in line with it. Other than to say is, you know, if we keep on telling ourselves and everybody else around us when we talk the philosophy is we don't know that, well, we may not fully know that, but there's stuff that we know. And if we act within the parameters of what we know with the right motive, those, you know, some people want to know everything about those causal spheres and how we affect that too. We're not going to know, but if we act with the right motive within the area of what we do know, then we also know, if we have faith in the law, it's got to have an effect that carries out a pure motive.
Yes. And once again, what do we basically know? We know that within ourselves there's something that is the witness and endures and lasts and can experience pain and suffering, but cannot be fundamentally hurt by it. It endures. And we also know that there is a law of cause and effect, of action and reaction, which is impersonal and operates whether we work with it or against it, the results will come. And we also know that as a result of experience, ours and others, people grow. So we can say, yes, we may not yet be able to judge and know what the effect of our actions is, but basically it doesn't matter for us at this point. If we act to the best of our ability and understanding of who and what we are, to the highest faith and conviction of what we be true, and leave the results of that to the law, the results will come. We'll either learn from it or we won't learn from it, but in the next experience of that, we'll know the results and be able to move forward and make changes. So we have to act in the moment, but we have to have faith in the law and that we will experience the results of those actions and learn from them. Yes, in the back.
In considering the larger picture we've just been given,
yes,
how it will affect everyone else,
yes,
we think maybe we should come up with our own little Hippocratic oath, like seek to do no harm,
yes,
seek to be helpful and useful, and above all, seek to be kind and gentle.
Yes.
So we think if we each did that, anything that we did that was going to have a sweeping effect would be useful and helpful and gentle, hopefully.
Yes. So we might say seek to mean no harm. Because who of us is wise enough to know at our stage whether we're actually doing harm or not? But seek to mean no harm. Seek to mean to be gentle. The most we can work with now is our motive, because what evolves, what changes during this path of our spiritual evolution is not our motive. It's our wisdom. It's how to put that motive into right action. We begin with the same motive of wanting to help others, but along the path, we learn how to do it better. Yes?
In our question, concentration and then application. A surgeon uses that before he begins his work. And he calls on his own will prayer, and then he applies what he knows. And law prevails in the long run, it would seem to me, because I'm thinking about the old Navy surgeon. You had to have three guys hold down the patient before you use your scalpel until someone discovered the sleeping gas, which made his work a lot easier. So could we have a discussion of what is meant by will prayer?
Will prayer. Well, we've discussed what we meant by prayer. Prayer, as Plato taught it, is an ardent turning of the soul to the divine, not for any particular good, but for good itself. Prayer is an identification with the eternal divine essence. And the only way we can know of that is what we know of it in ourselves. So it's a turning within. That's prayer. What then is will prayer? Having recognized that eternal divine essence, which is the same in each and all, the same in the atom, the same in the blade of grass, the same in the stone, in the plant, in the animal, the same in every human being, that divine essence. Will prayer is to act for and as that self of all to the best that we can under the circumstances. I will. I won't depend on some outside source, but I will do it because within me, as within every other aspect of life, is that unlimited power to act and to create and to move things forward. You know, the Brahma, the word Brahma, the Hindu word for the deity, means to grow, to expand. And so within each one of us is that same power to grow, expand, to bring forth, to make change. We just have to bring it into action by will, determination. And behind will, we say, stands desire. So we have to want to do it. We have to bring our desires up to a higher level, not just for our own personal pleasure and pain, but for the best we can understand the benefit of all. But that's a process of growth. These are ideals put before us that we work through, that we understand better as we go on this path of spiritual evolution. And since we are all individuals, we arrive at that stage in different ways and in our own on our own timetable, we might say. Yes, in the back.
Would you say that, or would you suggest that if we use this power of will, it should only be used in a positive mode rather than a negative mode?
Do you mean, in other words, saying I won't smoke anymore, rather than saying I won't smoke, I'll say when I feel the urge to smoke, I will do something else. Is that what you meant by a positive? Taking the positive action
rather than a negative.
Okay. Well, don't think of a pink elephant. You can't formulate the negative without coming up with that idea. And when you do come up with the idea, you inherently give it energy. You set up an obstacle. So yes, if you're going to, faith establishes the will and confirms the imagination. That's what Paracelsus says. Faith establishes the will and confirms the imagination. So if we have faith that some ideal is true, we want to set in our mind the ideal, the picture of it, of what it is, the belief in it, and then we will to act on that basis. Faith is step. If we believe something is true, then we will therefore will to act on it. But we have to hold in the mind the high ideal. So yes, in all our efforts to proceed, we want to form in our mind the end in view, the ideal in view. That's why we say, well, why do we study these high ethical and metaphysical ideas? Well, you know, we recognize our inherent and sometimes very difficult circumstances that we deal with as human beings every day, the obstacles, the many things that get away. Why are we spending so much time on the ideal? Because it is through those ideals and the power of faith and will that each one of us have that we can rise above them, that we can make changes. Without that ideal in view, without an understanding of what is possible, what we are working for, that faith and that will cannot be generated and bring forth the results. Yes.
So we need to have faith in ourselves that we're not weak, that we're not poor, miserable sinners. And that's an awful lot of, that's a long way to go for most people that have been raised in a religious background.
Mm-hmm. Yes. But faith establishes the will and confirms the imagination. If we imagine ourselves, because of by what we've been taught and heard over and over again, that we're weak, powerful, and animals, and separate, if that is our faith, our will or desire will be along that line, and our will will be necessarily limited because we'll only do what we think we personally can do. If we don't think we're possible of changing, we won't. But once we begin to study ideas and recognize the truth of them about ourselves, it changes our image of who and what we are. It changes our ideal. And as we begin to have faith and act along different ways. So, yes, it's difficult. So we say the first step is to gain knowledge, to study, to really check, test, and verify your own ideas. It's one thing to listen to what somebody else puts forward and make a critical judgment as, I don't like that, or I don't accept that, or that disagrees with my own previous understanding of things. It's even more difficult, but even more important, to just as critically examine what you already believe and find some yardstick by which to determine if it's true or not. Because what you own, what you already believe and own, is more likely to affect you than any wisdom out there. You have to understand yourself first in the light of those ideas. Yes.
Yeah, something, as we're discussing, something just really clicked along the lines of, you know, know and knowledge and all this. Because in Mr. Crosby's Friendly Philosopher, one of the letters that he responded to a student, his statement was right motive without knowledge is for naught. And that's what theosophy is for, studying the principles is for. And what we realize here is, it's not that we have to know what the cause of an effect is on infinitum of what we do. It's that we have to know the right basis for our action. That's the knowledge that we have to have. And we can have that.
Yeah.
We're not metaphysicians, but if we're, if we're students of life, you can have a certain basis for knowledge, act on that with a pure motive, and we think that's what he's talking about.
Yes. Yes, in other words, we could walk in this room and operate the lights in here as well as any PhD in physics or mechanical engineering. We don't have to know all the properties of electricities and wires and the conduction and capacitors. What we have to do is go there and flip the switch and leave it up to the law to take care of it. Well, in some ways, we are like that at our level. We just have to know how to flip the switch. But the flipping and the switching is going to depend on how well we understand our own ideas. You know, when we say somebody pushes our buttons, what are they doing? They are pushing the fundamental ideas and values of what we believe. And by doing that, they can turn us on and off. So the more one understands one's own nature, the less external forces can influence and the more self-control we begin to have. Because we understand what makes us would move and would not move. And we can change by changing those ideas. As Plato says, ideas rule the world. By changing the ideas, we change everything. Yes?
In trying to establish a greater understanding with ourselves, what's the role in focusing on how honest we can be with ourselves?
What's the role of being, of how honest? We think in order to be honest, there has to be a love of truth, or at least a search of truth, at least a faith that truth exists. So a faith, a power of faith. You have to believe that truth exists as an ideal, and it's something you're going to search for outside yourself, within yourself. Because as long as you don't have a love and faith of truth, how are you going to be honest? If you believe there is no ultimate truth, that all is deception and all is appearance, as the mantra goes today, perception is everything. Well, perception is nothing, because everything we perceive is illusionary and change. But if that's what you believe, that's the way you'll react. So in order to be honest and look at ourselves in the face, it's very difficult, but it's because we don't yet have enough love and faith and conviction in knowing the truth. When Socrates said to a student, when you want to know the truth as much as a drowning man wants to breathe, then I can teach you. When you want to know the truth as much as a drowning man wants to gasp of air, then you can learn. So we welcome you on Wednesday evening. We're going to be considering objection. Why, you know, does lack of memory disprove reincarnation? And a new effort next month to investigate the hidden laws of nature, beginning with the subject, the hidden side of nature. What is it? Our meeting's adjourned.
Express my idea.
Okay, all right. That's good. Yeah, that's